Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Well, welcome. This is Pat McDonald, your host for today for Vermont Viewpoint. Rick Sangari is not in the studio, and so we're going to spend the next 2 hours together talking about my favorite subject, food. Joining me this morning is Carrie Staler from the Government and Public Affairs Office for the Vermont Food Bank. Carrie, welcome. You're on the line.
I am. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. I'm so glad you could join us today. Could you talk briefly about your background and what you do at the Vermont Food Bank?
Yes. I actually recently joined the Vermont Food Bank in August. I'm coming to this work from 5 years as the Director of Community Engagement at Green Mountain United Way. And my job at the Food Bank is to focus on our advocacy, our government relations, and our public affairs work to help address food insecurity in Vermont. And previously, my work was in addressing financial insecurity, which we really see as one of the root causes of food insecurity. So I'm bringing that experience with me to the team at the Food Bank.
Well, you've joined a great group at the Vermont Food Bank. John Sales is one of my favorite Vermonters, and he and all of you at the Vermont Food Bank have done an incredible job. So when I had the opportunity to host, I really wanted to include you in this discussion to talk about COVID and all the work you've done to get through this pandemic, and we're still not quite on the other side yet. You've invited two of your partners to join us this morning. I'll introduce them, and then you can maybe say a few words about them. The first to join us is Dr. Meredith Niles, an assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Science at the University of Vermont. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Oh, this is great. I've done a lot of research for your coming on this morning, and I know we've got a lot to talk about, and your work is very impressive, I must say. So I'm looking forward to jumping in and getting that discussion. Our second guest is Faye Mack, who's the Advocacy and Education Director for Hunger Free Vermont's Policy Agenda and Coordination of Organization Advocacy Initiatives. Faye, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, good morning. I don't know much about the Vermont Hunger Free Vermont. We talked last night, and we've got to fix that a little bit because I don't know enough, and I'm embarrassed by it. So I'm looking forward to having you talk about your organization because I do know that it is a leader in Vermont with regard to food insecurity and. So I welcome you very much. So, Carrie, can you tell us how you work? I have it on good authority. I think Faye told me that you three work very closely together on a daily basis. So could you tell us a little bit about these partners and how important their support is to the Vermont Food Bank?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about that. I really wanted to invite Dr. Niles on to talk about some research that she and her team at UVM have done. It's really helped inform our work at the Vermont Food Bank in understanding what the impact of the pandemic has been on people who are experiencing food insecurity and the experience of Vermonters who were experiencing food insecurity prior to the pandemic, right? Because this isn't a new pandemic problem. This is something that Vermont has been challenged with for quite a while. So really for us to understand what she's learned and what her data is showing us is a helpful perspective in understanding what our solutions need to be. And Faye has really wonderful experience in her role at Hunger Free Vermont, particularly on childhood hunger, on broader policy issues. She can bring some details about programs, including like school meals and the impact on seniors from some programs to help us really understand the broad perspective of folks who are experiencing food insecurity. And then I'm here to really talk about this on-the-ground logistics of moving food around the state, of working with our 300-plus network partners around the state to understand local community action and those impacts that those communities have had and what they've been able to do to address food for their neighbors, you know, and food insecurity issues that they're seeing in their local communities, and how we're able to work together to ensure that Vermonters who are experiencing food insecurity can access the food that they need.
That's great. Carrie, I'm sure you know this, but I say it almost every chance I get. The one out of three Vermonters deal with food insecurity, which is that a correct percentage?
Yes, that, well, maybe we should ask Dr. Niles. That is the number that we most often use at this point. Yes, that one in three Vermonters.
Well, that's a good segue to get to talk to Meredith. That number just drives me crazy in an agricultural state. Because I think you can't tell from looking at the people's houses whether they in fact deal with food insecurity or not, because from what I understand, that's the first thing that gets pulled back if money is tight in a house. It's food. You have to pay your mortgage and, you know, your car loan and all of those things. But food is something that you've got some control over. So, Meredith, welcome to the show. Your interest in food is very interesting to me. I know I read that you've got three primary areas of interest related to sustainable food security, and that's ensuring sustainable food production, food access and security in a changing world, and food waste behavior. Do I have that right?
That's right. Those are the three main areas of my research, and I do that work both in Vermont and nationally and even internationally in some cases as well.
Ah, that's great. Well, I read quite a bit of your work online on UVM's website and found it fascinating. So could you provide us a brief overview of the work you've been doing, and as you talked about, through your work here but also your national work?
Sure, absolutely. So that number that you've heard is a number that came from our research since the start of the pandemic, that about one in three Vermonters have faced food insecurity. And my team, primarily myself and Dr. Emily Bellarmino and Dr. Farrell Burtman at the University of Vermont, we started doing research here in Vermont and nationally in March of 2020, right when the pandemic started. And as we were all seeing the grocery store shelves start to go empty, remember that? And there was toilet paper and we couldn't get anything. We started to realize this was going to be a much bigger, probably longer term challenge for many Vermonters. So we, since that time in the last year and a half, our team has done five different surveys of Vermonters to really understand what people are facing, what challenges they've had, how they're dealing with food insecurity or making changes in their food habits. We also did a survey last summer of Vermont farmers and food businesses as well to understand how they were impacted by the pandemic. And that one in three number that you noted is what we have found, that roughly within the first year of the pandemic, about one in three Vermont households did face food insecurity at some point during that time period.
So could you define food insecurity? Is that
absolutely
because I'm sure it's different with everybody, maybe.
Right. So some people might be more familiar with the term hunger or hungry. Those are, they're slightly different terms. So when we refer to food insecurity in our research, what we use to define that is a set of six questions from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And those six questions from the U.S. Department of Agriculture are used by many other researchers and also by the U.S. government to track and understand food insecurity over time. So we're able to compare our results, for example, to other research, to other data that might be out there. Those six questions primarily have to do with affording food, you know, whether people worry about being able to afford enough food, whether they actually couldn't afford enough food. But then also there are some questions more on the hunger side of thinking about food insecurity. So whether people had to cut meals, for example, or skip meals, or couldn't afford high quality, nutritious foods. So it's a series of six questions, and if someone answers affirmatively to two or more of those questions, we classify them as food insecure.
That's really interesting. And again, I repeat that we live in an agricultural state, so that always bothers me. So I'm looking forward to finding out the reasons why. Meredith, I'd like to talk to you about some key findings from your studies. But first, we go to the phones, and Karen from Hardwick is calling in. Karen, I hope you weren't waiting too long.
No. I'm wondering if you could talk about the distribution of the funds that the food bank does get. We know that John Sales is getting $120,000 a year, which seems to me excessive for a charity organization. But are the rest of the workers similarly compensated?
Carrie, I don't know if you're in a position to talk about that. And
well, I got the information from John when he was on this program.
Yeah, John is not with us this morning. Carrie Staler is with the Vermont Food Bank. So I don't know, Carrie, do you have that information, or is it on your website, which some nonprofits put on their website?
I don't have that information at my fingertips. We do have our tax information. Our 990 is on our website, and you can find some of that information there. But most of the money that we raise is not going to staff salaries. It's really going toward food purchasing. I can tell you that for certain.
Right. Yes. Well, I know I'm very impressed with the Vermont Food Bank and the work that John has done. And I, so Karen, I don't have that specific answer. If you want to leave your, information here, I'll get it for you and get back to you. Thanks for calling in. Meredith, maybe we can go back to you and talk a little bit about what you found during the first year of your research.
Sure, thank you. So as I mentioned before, we've done five surveys, and so we've really been trying to track this over time. And in particular, we have one group of Vermonters we have followed over the first year of the pandemic, and then also surveyed some other Vermonters. And let me just give you a little snapshot of some of the things that we found in the first year of the pandemic. So as we already mentioned, about one in three Vermonters faced food insecurity at some point in that time period. One thing that I think is really interesting to understand is that a lot of these households were already food insecure. And so our research has shown that households that were food insecure before COVID were also very likely to continue to be food insecure during the pandemic, and in fact be harder hit by some of the aspects of the pandemic. For example, previously food insecure households were more likely to have lost their job or had a job disruption, which, you know, of course, further impacted their financial situation, maybe making them even worse off than before the pandemic. And we've also identified certain demographic groups were especially vulnerable in this year. Women in particular more likely to be food insecure, households with children, households without a college degree, as well as BIPOC and or Hispanic Vermonters as well. In fact, our most recent analysis found that BIPOC and Hispanic Vermonters were about 10 times greater odds of facing food insecurity in the first year of the pandemic. One other thing that's really interesting as we think about solutions and support, like my colleagues on the phone help provide, is the job disruptions were really widespread. And so our surveys have suggested that, you know, almost a half of Vermont households had some kind of job disruption in the first year of the pandemic, whether that was an actual job loss or maybe a furlough or a loss of hours or unemployment or loss of income. But only about a quarter of all households received some kind of unemployment. So that really starts to highlight for you, for example, Pat, the gap between the impact, financial impact that people face and the level of assistance that some people got but not everyone got, and why we continue to see higher rates of food insecurity even today than we did before the pandemic started.
So could I just stop a second and ask Carrie and Faye, what did your organizations do with all of this information? I'm sure it was very helpful to the way you do your business to know where the gaps are and what areas need the most support. Carrie, sure, can we start with you?
Yeah, I'm happy to give a few examples. One of the best examples I think I have is for, BIPOC Vermonters. We've been focusing some of our work in Chittenden County, particularly on new American populations, and have been working with a local farmer in that area who grows a specific kind of eggplant that, some of our new American African populations use in their cooking. And so we've been working with her to provide that kind of food to those communities and make that connection between, food that they recognize and eat and farming and the farming community there. I would also say there's an example of a program it's a pilot program right now, where we're operating our Veggie Van Go, which is a produce, program where we distribute produce in communities in the Winooski school, so that students who go to that school can bring food and other items home to their families. They don't have to go somewhere else to get that food. So we're working on this from a variety of angles, whether it's access, whether it's food choice. We're using the information that Dr. Miles has to really think about how to go deeper into some of those communities and some of those demographic populations to make sure that they have the access to food that they need.
Faye, do you have anything that you could add to the information that Dr. Niles has provided?
Sure. We're so grateful for the research that Dr. Niles has led. And because of the research that she's led through the pandemic, Vermont has had access to data that a lot of other states haven't had. And it's been really helpful, both in the way that Carrie was describing, where the data helps our organizations and our partners make programmatic decisions about where to focus energies and what kind of strategies should be our priorities. It also really helps, data really helps shed light on what hunger looks like in Vermont. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of myths out there about who is facing hunger and why they're facing hunger and what resources that there are that are available. And the data that Dr. Niles has collected really helps us understand and tell the story that Vermonters and people in Vermont from all walks of life are facing food insecurity, that food insecurity is connected to high cost of living, to job disruption, to healthcare concerns related to the pandemic, to transportation barriers, all of these different kinds of barriers that folks are facing when trying to put food on the table. How it's connected to a broader picture. Food insecurity is not the result of a poor personal decision or someone, choosing not to work. There are really deep structural and systemic reasons behind why people are struggling with food insecurity, and some of this data around how BIPOC communities in Vermont and single parents with children and all of these different populations are struggling helps to really tell the story. You were saying earlier that Vermont is an agricultural state, and it's true. And part of that and our resourcefulness as people in Vermont means that hunger is often invisible in communities. And
right.
The data really helps us understand that it is everywhere and it's in every community in our state.
That's great. So I just wanted to ask one more question of Carrie and Faye. Did you identify, and maybe Dr. Niles could answer this as well, what new trends did you identify? What have you seen that's different and new during this pandemic? Because the way we work, everything about the way we live has changed, and I'm sure this is no exception. Dr. Niles, maybe you could start with that.
Sure. We definitely did identify some interesting new trends, and we're actually continuing to follow these. So, of course, we were trying to understand impacts on food security, but we've also been tracking how people have changed eating
for example, and we did see, you know, a reduction in fruit and vegetable intake, for example, especially among food insecure households. We've also identified a reduction in meat consumption, also especially among food insecure households. You know, I just saw, it came across my desk this morning that the consumer price index, the inflation for meat products has gone up 10% this past September compared to a year before. You know, so we know that some of these products are becoming more expensive, and that is impacting how people are eating. One of the other things that we identified in our work last summer, and we have a grant to continue to follow and understand this here in Vermont and also in Maine, is a real strong increase in home food procurement, gardening, hunting, fishing, foraging. You know, the Vermont Agency of Fish and Wildlife, I know they had record licenses for fishing and hunting last year. We also identified a huge increase in all of those activities, especially among food insecure households, actually. So we're trying to understand if those things are continuing, you know, a year and a half out, and if that's something that Vermonters want to continue to increase. And obviously that would have a lot of implications for where we might need to provide new programs or new kinds of support, as well as for conservation efforts in the state as well. So a lot of changes, you know, what people are eating, how they're cooking, what they're growing, how they're engaging with food in their community. And then, of course, with our farmer survey, we did identify a growth in community-supported agriculture and CSAs and people really turning towards local farms at the start of the pandemic when those grocery store shelves were empty. And so I think a lot of Vermonters remembered, oh, we do live in an agricultural state and we have a wonderful opportunity to support our local farmers. And many of them also face challenges with trying to pivot to new business models. You know, they might have been selling to a school that was no longer operating, and so now they were trying to pivot towards a farm stand or something like that. So we also worked with the Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets to help them understand what farmers were facing and where they might also need programmatic support to change their business models.
That's great. We're going to have to take a hard break in just a minute, and we'll be returning. I've got a couple of questions about outreach and how you all let folks know who are dealing with this issue, what services are available, and also to ask you why people ate less vegetables in the beginning, if I heard that right. This is WDEV, and this is Vermont Viewpoint. Pat McDonald hosting today. We'll be right back at you.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Okay, and we're back. This is Pat McDonald, your host for today for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Joining me today is Dr. Meredith Niles from UVM, Faye Mack from Hunger Free Vermont, and Carrie Staler from the Vermont Food Bank. So, Meredith, I wanted to ask you, I thought you mentioned that people in the beginning of the pandemic were eating less vegetables. Did I get that right?
You got that right. Yeah, that's what our early data suggested, and some of our longer-term data suggests that trend might be staying, especially for food-insecure households. And what we think is going on there is, you know, in some cases, fruit and vegetables can cost more than other types of food. And so if someone faced an economic shock and they had to cut their food budget, they were going towards things like meat and vegetables first. And, you know, this is where I think programs like the Veggie Van Gogh that Carrie mentioned earlier and the efforts of the food bank have been really, really helpful. And we actually published a paper over the summer that was led by my colleague at UVM, Farrell Burtman, where we were able to show that at least here in Vermont, food insecure households that utilized food banks and food pantries did not reduce their fruit and vegetable intake at the same way that people who were food insecure and didn't use those places did. So we do have some evidence that the great work they're doing is really making a difference in the community.
Did I understand that you have to leave us soon?
I do. You know, I actually have to go meet with my team to talk more about our research and to plan some upcoming events. So I'm happy to answer any last questions you might have before I hop off.
Well, I think just what changes are coming. We've listed some of the surprises, some of the things that came up new. What do you hope for in the future with all of this data that we're going to change things? Yeah. I hope are there recommendations that go along with all of your information?
Yes, we often in our policy briefs we put out, we have implications and policy components to our work. We've also shared all of our research directly with state agencies and our congressional delegation, who I know have taken this to Washington and tried to advocate for programmatic changes. You know, we're keeping our eye on the inflation issue because what we do know from previous recessions is that it can take years, 5 to 10 years in some cases, for food insecurity levels to drop back to recession times. So this isn't a problem that's going away overnight, unfortunately, and it's why we're continuing to do this analysis and to share this data the way that we are. But we're also, trying to find some of the silver linings in this work and to focus on some of the positive things that we found as well. For example, we really were able to show how many Vermonters were helping each other in the early part of the pandemic. We have data on that, and we could talk about the impact of helping out your neighbors. And we're also really trying to understand, for example, this home food procurement and this increase in gardening and how that might help connect people to more fruits and vegetables and to, more physical activity, for example. So we're definitely continuing our work. We have some grants currently submitted that we're hoping to continue to fund this work for several more years. And we're really grateful to have the community partners and the state agency support that we do.
Well, we thank you for all the work you're doing. How can folks, there's so much information on your website. It's on your page on UVM if people want to check it out further. Very interesting read. And I really thank you very much for joining us, and have a good rest of your day.
All right. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Pat.
Take care. Thanks. Anytime. Thank you. So, Carrie and Faye, back to you. How have you gotten the word out about what's available for people? Because if you've not dealt with this issue before, you probably don't know where to go for help.
You know, I think that's a really great point, Pat. A lot of the folks who are experiencing food insecurity right now may have never had this experience before, so are not connected to that system of support that we have throughout the state. I think there's a page on our website, which is really easy for people to get to, and it's vtfoodbank.org/get-help. It's all one word, G-E-T-H-E-L-P. And that has a great list of programs that people might be eligible for. It has a link to find a food shelf. We have over 215 food shelves, meal sites, of our network partners in the community who are distributing food every day. And that is often the most local and accessible way for people to get food assistance. And then there are other great programs like Three Squares Vermont, which I think Faye can probably go into a lot more detail about, that will allow people to go right to the grocery store and purchase whatever food that they want that's eligible for that Three Squares benefit. So there's a whole host of different options. And we also have a number people can call, and we can help walk them through what those choices might be if they're having a hard time sort of figuring out what the best options for them.
That's great. Did you see any slowdown in your ability to get the food and to distribute it in the beginning of the pandemic? That must have taken a little bit of coordination.
Yes. At the beginning, there were some challenges getting food from our regular vendors and for getting the kinds of food and the quantities of food. And I think the Vermont Food Bank team really did an incredible job getting food from, you know, all sorts of places. During the pandemic, we also were able to expand some of our local purchasing programs. For example, our Vermonters Feeding Vermonters program is a program that purchases local produce from local farms and distributes that throughout our network. And that program expanded like 165% or something.
Whoa.
It was a big shift for us. And part of that was because, you know, that was food that was available and we could move quickly from farms to communities without having to address national supply chain issues. That, you know, that said, we still get lots and lots of our food from all sorts of different places around the country. And so really the food bank team, it was a heavy lift to shift in the beginning. Once things sort of smoothed out, that became easier, and it became easier to procure and move food. And I would say now we're not seeing a lot of those problems. So
that's great.
Yeah,
Dr. Niles alluded to something, and that I have seen during this whole pandemic is the level of generosity of Vermonters. When they're able to give, they give, whether it's in-kind services, it's funding, the several nonprofits that I'm involved in have seen quite a bit of increase in dollar contributions. Vermonters just really stepped it up, and I'm sure you've seen that over this whole cycle of pandemic, that people are just helping thy neighbor, as they say. So I presume that's what you're seeing.
Yes, the generosity from our community members, from our donors, from volunteers who really make a lot of our work possible has been unbelievable. And I will say that, you know, we're really operating now on a monthly basis at about twice the level that we were operating at prior to the pandemic, which is a huge increase for our organization. It's, you know, the expenses are higher, the output is higher. There's more food moving into those community food shelves. So they're having to do more work. Their volunteers and their organizations are having to do more. And really, we couldn't do all of this without the support that you're talking about. And Vermonters have made this possible, and they have made it a priority. I'll also say that, you know, support from the state of Vermont and from the federal government was more available during the pandemic.
For sure.
And that made a huge difference. It really made a difference when the government said food and making sure people are fed is a priority.
Absolutely.
And that kind of help really, I think, demonstrated to us and you know, really showed us that when our leaders put their minds to it, we can solve hunger and we can solve food insecurity. And a lot of these actions that were taken really made a big dent. Like Dr. Niles was talking about, they saw the rate of food insecurity, you know, go up, but it didn't, you know, it didn't go up hugely. We had challenges, but we were able to manage a lot of those with the programs and resources that were mobilized during the pandemic. And I think that is a huge lesson.
Awesome.
That we're taking forward. Yeah. Like when we put our minds to it, we can do that.
We can do it. We're Vermonters. We do have a caller, Nola from Ripton. Nola?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's a lovely October morning.
Yes, it is. We should all be outside. But that's another story. Can I help you?
I just wanted to throw this out, and I know it's a thought that's been used over and again, but the idea of involving people with providing themselves with food with more local gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this as an organic farmer, but also as someone that's done gardens with young children, with inner city kids, and with college students. There's a certain magic that comes from eating the food that you helped grow. And it just creates a commitment. It's not a, you do this, but it's just, I want to see that plant grow.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me that could be a wonderful way to really get good food to people without too much trauma and stress and shipping and all the rest of it, and to use this amazing land in Vermont that we have. So why pave it over for a parking lot when we can dig it up for a garden?
I must agree with you, and I think Dr. Niles alluded to that a lot of people, because of the pandemic, are switching to homegrown foods, and we're going to have the attorney for the agricultural agency on after our second hour, and that would I'll bring that question up to him. I'm not sure if Faye Mack, if you've seen that in Hunger Free Vermont, whether people are taken to the soil, which would be a very good thing for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah, sure. It's a really good point and a great idea. We do a lot of work to try to help folks who are interested in gardening to be able to do that and to be able to purchase local foods. So Carrie earlier had mentioned the Three Squares Vermont program.
Right.
And one of the great benefits of that program is another program called Crop Cash, which can help double your benefit amounts at local farmers markets and farm stands, which can help people buy local food, which is great. And this month is actually Farm to School and Early Childhood Month, which is one of the big programs across the state that really help young people connect to the local agricultural system and to, you know, hands in the dirt kind of activities. And as the caller had mentioned, you know, having that experience growing food can help build a commitment and interest in fresh and local food. And that's really where we see the potential for impact. Growing a garden is a really great activity, to help supplement someone's, food. It alone won't solve hunger and can't fully meet everyone's needs, especially when folks are trying to work multiple jobs and take care of their kids, especially during the pandemic when folks and children are at home more often. But it's certainly a very important piece to the puzzle.
Well, and I must say, Nola didn't mention that the food tastes better, too. And I'm sure that if kids – I know a lot of schools are allowing the kids to grow vegetables and the products on the school ground. And what a great experience. So thank you very much for that call, Nola. I so agree with you. So, Faye, let's talk about Hunger Free Vermont. As I said in the beginning of the program, shame on me for not knowing that much about Hunger Free Vermont, but we're going to fix that. I also read that Hunger Free Vermont is one of Vermont's leading anti-hunger advocacy and education organizations, which kudos to you all. I noticed that many of your programs deal with school meals, and you've mentioned some of it now. School meals, summer meals, after-school meals. Could you talk to us about those programs and the impact COVID had on your efforts to get food to our children?
Absolutely. So Hunger for Vermont, just briefly, as an organization, we work to our mission is to end the injustice of hunger and malnutrition for everyone in Vermont. And so a big piece of that is ensuring that folks who are in need have access to really high-quality federal programs. So there are a combination of local programs and federal programs that really round out the ways in which we are working to make sure that people have enough food and are able to put food on their table. And one major part of that is making sure that kids are fed during school and during when they're in childcare and wherever they are in their day. And, you know, we had mentioned earlier in the show how programs had been expanded during the pandemic, and the way that the federal government has responded to making sure that children have access to food is one of the real shining lights of the pandemic response. So there are a number of different federal programs, like you mentioned, school meals, summer meals, after-school meal programs, and child care programs that help provide meals throughout the day for children. And during the pandemic, the programs have been expanded. In particular, school meals have been expanded so that school breakfast and lunch, it's free in almost every school in Vermont right now for students. And so that means that any student who is eligible or who wants to eat a school meal can eat a school meal along with their peers rather than only being eligible dependent on their parents or their caregiver's income. And one of the big lessons of the pandemic has been that
that when we expand these kinds of programs and lower barriers to entry and make it easier for folks who might be struggling to access it, including kids, we see that more people participate because the stigma against taking help goes down. And so that has been a really incredible evolution in schools that we're working to make permanent in the State House right now.
That's great. Could you talk about, we mentioned it before, about Three Squares Vermont. That's actually a federal program.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old, not the old, but the current SNAP program, and we've renamed it to say Three Squares. Could you talk about that? And I read about the Three Squares Vermont Challenge. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So Three Squares Vermont is the federal SNAP program, which is a program that gives eligible households money to spend on groceries in grocery stores, food co-ops, farmers markets, and a lot of other stores across the state and across the country. And it's the nation's largest food assistance program and really helps folks buy the kinds of foods that their family like to eat and put food on the table on a day-to-day basis. And right now, benefits are actually higher than they've ever been. There was a historic increase in benefits at the beginning of October. So it's a really great time to apply, and a lot of people are eligible who don't know it. Carrie earlier had mentioned the Food Bank's website is a great place to find information. I would also add that Vermont 211 is an incredible resource. People can just call 211 or they can go to their website, and the folks at 211 can help a caller understand all the different programs that they might be eligible and send them in the right direction to get access to programs like Three Squares Vermont.
So, Faye, I don't mean to interrupt you. We have to go to a hard break, which means we just have to stop. But I want to thank both of you and also Dr. Niles for coming on the show. Fabulous information. It sounds like Vermonters are rising to the challenge, and your staffs are doing yeoman's work. So I thank you all very much for being on the program. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint, and we will be back for the next hour. My guest will be Steve Collier, General Counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, to continue our discussion on food. Thank you all very much.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald. I'm your host for today for Vermont Viewpoint. Rick Sangari is not in the studio. We've been talking about food, my favorite subject, and joining me to continue that discussion is Steve Collier, who's the General Counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. Welcome, Steve.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
No, this is fun. We've not met, so this will be a good chance to get to know each other. We're going to talk about, I was looking at their list of legislation. I worked this summer with a friend of mine to talk about legislation over the summer, because there's so much stuff that passes that people have no clue about. They may know the five or six bills that the media covers, but the rest of the 95 bills or whatever it is, I think it was up to 100 this year. You must have kept very busy up at the legislature.
We think we always are quite busy, actually. And you know, but we're very fortunate in that we have two committees in the House and the Senate who are there on the same page with us. I mean, that's not great. On every issue, every time, but they want to help farmers. They recognize the importance of farming in Vermont, and they are committed to doing everything they can to make keeping Vermont what it is. So it's a pleasure to be in those environments. It's not always easy, but we enjoy it, and we think it's a pretty good partnership.
Oh, that's very good to hear. There's not as many farmers as there used to be, working farmers, in the legislature years ago, because in the winter, what a great place for them to spend their time, right?
It's a real loss having that perspective and having it. And it's something that, you know, more and more legislators are becoming somewhat professional, which has its advantages. But it's having that citizen legislature is important, we think, to Vermont, and having the farmer's voice is important. So if you're out there in our board in the winter, give it a thought. Give it some thought.
Run, people, run. Exactly. So there was something on your website, which before we get into this legislation, because I noticed all of your bills, they're all act numbers, so they all passed.
Well, the ones that are there have certainly all passed. I think there were some other – every major policy initiative that we were working on, something came through.
That's great, because as folks may know, it's a House bill or a Senate bill, and unless it passes both the bodies and goes to the governor's desk for signature or – he doesn't sign it, but anyway, it becomes an act, and that makes it official. So you must have done good work. But it said on your website, and I just needed to ask you what you were referring to. If this was your statement, I don't know. 2020 was a year of turbulence, uncertainty, and change, with many important societal issues highlighted by the coronavirus pandemic. The Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets has been deeply involved in many of these issues. Could you discuss and tell me what those societal issues are you're referring to?
Sure. I think that was a statement from our Secretary Anson Tebbets, but it's on behalf of the agency, and it affects all parts of our agency. I've only been with the agency since 2 months before the pandemic, so I started in January of 2020. And I like to joke that I was there 2 months before my boss sent me home. So
I see you're working at home?
I have been. I'm actually going to go back next week. But a lot of people are still working at home. But it's almost surreal looking back at it, because I don't think any of us, at least in my generation, and I've been around for a while, really envisioned this kind of thing happening. And when you look back to terms now that we're so familiar with, like social distancing, that wasn't even in our vocabulary, or at least most of our vocabulary before. Or traveling, maybe you would see one or two people wearing a mask, and oftentimes those were folks from countries who had experienced MERS or SARS in the early 2000s. Our society has undergone some incredible changes in the last, you know, 18 to 20 months, and they're ongoing. And the future is still being constructed as we go. So to think about how we've evolved in such a short period of time, I mean, the economy was shut down a lot of the economy was shut down, but not farmers. Farmers can't be shut down. You can't stop food production. You can't stop what they were doing. And so when you talk about the turbulence, I mean, when Governor Scott first came on TV, and I think so many Vermonters were watching, and was talking about the stay-at-home order, think about that sort of transition that happened. So from the beginning, all of us, I think, were trying to figure out how do we continue to operate as society. We obviously need our food. We need our farmers. How can we do that safely when we didn't even know how the virus spread? I mean, or very well how it spread. Right. I mean, you remember people going to the grocery store and sanitizing all of their food.
Except when I came home, I'd be wiping down boxes and oranges and things. I'm like, what is going on?
Why wouldn't you?
Well, exactly.
So even now, I mean, over 700,000 Americans have died since last year. That's more than there are Vermonters. That's more than the United States has lost in any war in its history, just since last year. So it's trying to navigate how we continue while we're also dealing with a global pandemic that we haven't seen since 1918. So, you know, we in the legislature and the governor and our secretary and our agency have just been working with Vermonters, with farmers, to try to make sure that we can continue as best as possible. So I think that's what the secretary was referencing. And on a more individual basis, I mean, it started out with safety. How do we do this as safely as we can? And there's no such thing as absolute safety, right? There wasn't before, and there isn't now. So it's what can we do to put ourselves in the best posture possible? And I think throughout, most Vermonters have been incredibly proud of how all Vermonters have stepped up. And we've had some recent flare-ups with Delta that is causing some concerns. But in general, I don't think any state has fared any better than the state of Vermont during that time. And then economic security. You know, when the pandemic first stopped and restaurants closed and schools stopped and the milk price fell through the floor, and this is after years of devastating dairy prices, and suddenly the milk price might be 15 $20 a hundredweight, or I think it may have even got a little bit less than that. How do you keep farmers in business? So there was a lot of concern about when a time when we all need food more than ever. I mean, we always need food, but when it was more at risk, how do we keep things operating? So there was a lot of work put into supporting farmers economically with our partnership with the congressional delegation, with federal money. And so there was a long period of just trying to keep people, I think as the governor put it, trying to get them to survive so that we can later thrive. And then the, another piece is the access to food, which I think you were talking about in the previous hour. I mean, there's always been an issue with people who can't afford food. Suddenly there were more people who couldn't afford food, and the supply chain was being disrupted. And, you know, as bad as that's all been, I think it also has been – it's an important thing for all of us to think about as we move forward. How do we ensure that we're not overly reliant on sources of food that we really have no control over? How do we keep agriculture in Vermont? Because, you know, we used to be a nation of farmers, and now less than 1% or approximately 1% of people in this country are farmers. Vermont has a strong, proud farming tradition. But that is not guaranteed without effort and people and commitment. And so that's what our agency, in a large part, is trying to ensure, is that Vermont can continue to be a prosperous and successful agricultural state.
And I think Anson and I have talked about this on the show and on the TV show I do, that we have lost a lot of farms, but milk production has actually gone up because of technology. And the technology that farmers have to buy, which is a big expense for them, but on their farms to keep that production up for us of particularly milk. So it's a fascinating, I think it's fascinating what's happened to farms and how they have to adapt and live under all the regulations that we put them under. And
well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it has been an interesting story that I think hasn't maybe been told enough, is that as many farms as we've lost, and every time you lose a farmer who wants to continue farming because they can't afford to do it, that's a loss.
Yes, for sure.
On the other hand, you know, and I was, we were talking to a farmer recently, an old time farmer whose family's been doing it for generations, and he said it in that understated way that you love Vermonters, and it was something like, you know, most of us farmers who are left, we're pretty good at it. And that was a sort of a profound statement, and it's true that farmers have improved. They you know, they're able to keep the milk production up, but recently that has dropped some. For most of our history, I think the production has been pretty steady or increased. In the last 2 or 3 years, it has dropped, and I think that's partly due to COVID. But you know, one thing we wonder about is, once lost, can we get it back?
Yeah.
You know, it's the startup costs are so high, and succession planning is such a challenge.
Many of their kids just don't want to get into dad's and mom and dad's business, do they?
It's hard work.
Yeah, it is.
And it's 7 days a week.
Oh, dark hundred, right?
365.
It's dark when they get up, man. I'm still in bed watching ER. That's my morning go-to show. So anyway, let's just switch a little bit to the legislation. You had your first thing I had written down was the good old appropriations bill, which I don't know how much you know about, but money's good. Your agency budget is $31 million. That's a good number. But they included in there some interesting items. For me, it was the slaughter, meat processing, and the training proposal funding that they gave you. I told you this before the show that I was in Maine, and I should have mentioned this in the previous hour. I went to the store one day, and I couldn't buy the meat. It was so expensive. I thought, what am I doing? So I came home. I told my husband, I said, nope, we're not having any steak tonight. And long story short, I found a place that sells farm slaughtered and sold meat right from the farm, and it was less expensive and it tasted better. And so I see right by the clock I have to stop talking for a moment and take a break, but we'll be back and maybe you can talk about slaughtering in Vermont and meat processing and whether it's kind of caught on a little bit that's a good place to buy food.
Sure.
Okay, great. I mentioned to Steve when I was in Maine, I went to the food store one day, and we're big meat eaters in my family, and I couldn't pay the price. I just couldn't. I went home. I told my husband, nope, we're eating chopped meat. That's it. but a lot of people are turning to farms. and buying meat right off the farm, are they not?
Well, they definitely are, and we have a so the way that the federal meat regulation system is basically constructed is that it's governed by the feds. So the USDA inspects meat in slaughterhouses, but they allow states to have their own state meat inspection program as long as the standards are at least equivalent to the federal standards. So we're very happy to have and to have a proud and terrific meats program within the state. So we have both in the state of Vermont, we have both federally inspected and state inspected meat. The traditional difference is that a state inspected meat can only be sold within the borders,
right,
whereas federally inspected meat can be sold across the country and beyond.
Right.
Really interestingly, though, it was I believe it was earlier this year, but it may have been late last year, Vermont was either the first or one of the first states to sign a cooperative agreement with USDA.
Yep. Right.
So that state-inspected slaughterhouses could actually and processors could actually sell out of state as well.
Right.
So that's a welcome development, and it gives more opportunities. But, you know, the pandemic exposed some bottlenecks in across the country and in Vermont with slaughter and processing. So that's something we're actively working on. There's part of that appropriation that you discussed. The agency did get its full budget, which you know is all we think well used, but it was also notable, I think, that during the pandemic, as the economy was slowing down, to be able to keep the government going was important.
Right.
And without federal aid and without federal assistance, it may not have been possible to do that. So
now, you mentioned slaughterhouses, and I remember when I worked at state government, slaughterhouses or lack thereof in Vermont was almost a crisis, that they didn't have any place to bring the product. Are we gotten better at that, or?
I think we've gotten better, but we have a ways to go. And part of one of the things that the appropriation did was there were actually, so we have something called the Working Lands Enterprise Board,
right,
which was started back in 2012, and its objective is to keep, it's sort of like it sounds, is to keep keep agricultural and forestry production open and viable in Vermont. So it's been it's a very successful program, but it's been quite limited in scope just because the amount of money appropriated to it has been fairly small, typically about $594,000, which when you spread that upon multiple businesses, you know, it's helpful,
yeah,
and it's useful,
right,
and it's done great work. But you spread that up, and it's a fairly small amount going to each business. But this year, in total, the legislature appropriated $5,594,000. Yeah, it was and some of that, at least $500,000 of that, was committed to bolstering our slaughter and processing.
Right.
In fact, processing has almost been more of a bottleneck than the slaughter itself. So there's actually.
Oh, could you explain that? So getting to the slaughter is one thing, but then what happens after that? What does the farmer have to do?
Well, it's not the farmer, right? It's the processor.
Ah.
So it's chopping it up into usable bits for sale. So it's one thing to slaughter the animal, another thing to cut it up into.
So are they two different entities? There's the slaughterhouse and the processor?
It can be both.
Yeah.
It depends on the
right
business.
There.
The business can choose to slaughter. There's separate licensing for both, but
yeah,
they can choose to do one or both. And there's some other things they can do as well. But so there, the legislature recognized that problem, as did we, and we are working to address it. In fact, right now there are, I think it's 6 open grant opportunities for people.
Great.
And they cover a wide variety of things, including meat processing and slaughtering. And I think the meat processing and slaughtering grants go up to $150,000. Maybe it's $100,000 for them. But you should go to our website. There's a Working Lands page, and there are 6 different open grants. So anyone
Super.
Who's thinking about developing their agricultural business right now should take a look.
Am I remembering correctly that we had a portable slaughter facilities way back when, or am I making that up?
You know, that's a little before my time,
oh, okay.
but I do think that there have been some, and as long as they're licensed, they can.
They can. Well, just to fill that gap, because as I was telling you, in Maine, I was talking to these people where I started to buy my meat, and they have to bring their product 2 hours.
Right.
And you want to talk cost, if they're spending 2 hours of their time each way, That's got to add to the cost of the final product.
It sure does. And as I understand it, a lot of Vermont farmers have been using Pennsylvania slaughterhouses for some of their animals. And I don't know what percentage that is or the scope, but there's not traditionally been enough for all of the demand.
Yeah.
But part of that is the consumer demand as well.
Right. Like
you only want slaughtering it here and processing it here makes more sense when people want to buy it here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a circle.
Well, maybe if the price keeps going at the food stores, that they're going to see more customers on the farm. Because we've got quite a few in this area. I actually wrote to Ensign, the secretary, and I said I wanted to know about if they get inspected, if that's a standard thing. And he said exactly what you said. It's state for local. And the USDA at the time, besides the compact, I didn't know about that. Right. But anyway, it made me feel good.
Well, we believe that, you know, the more that we want people to buy Vermont food across the board.
Right.
And so as some of our dairy farms don't believe it's viable to stay in dairy, perhaps they transition to beef or to other ruminants or to
pork. Lots of stuff.
I mean, we support all forms of agriculture, and our objective is that when you drive into the state of Vermont or when you live in the state of Vermont, you're still going to see that open land, that thing that drives and moves us all. We don't want to become a state of subdivisions and second homes only.
Yep.
We may want those things too, but we really want a state that's viable for our agricultural community.
That's great. The budget also included our agricultural fair days. We love them.
We sure do, and they struggled. They were shut down for a year. So they really.
But are they back this year?
They were back this year, and I believe they did quite well, and maybe even surprisingly well under the circumstances.
That's great. Well, I think Vermonters are starting to loosen up a little bit. I must say I never stopped going out to restaurants. I went right about, did I get yelled at here? I have to take a break. I'm sitting here gabbing away, having too much fun talking about this. We'll be right back. There's a lot to talk about, particularly about agrotourism, which is a favorite topic of mine. This is Pat McDonald. I'm your host for Vermont The Viewpoint on WDEV. Okay. Well, we have 3 minutes. I'm going to keep talking. See that? I haven't done this in a while. You're saying you're new. I haven't done this in a while. Let's talk really quickly about Housing and Conservation Board. I've always struggled. I see Housing and Conservation Board tied to your agency, but it's really the conservation part that you work with them closely.
That's right. I think they have a lot of different missions, but the one of I think biggest import is to us is they purchase farmland to conserve it. So they purchase conservation easements, which keeps agricultural land in agricultural use. So that's a really important program. I think it started in the late 1980s. And it's something that we work with them in partnership on.
Yeah, that's good. Well, we need to conserve our land for sure. Because as you said, what is that song about, pave paradise and put up a parking lot? They also gave, the Farmland Forest Viability Program, $50,000 to that. What is that program?
So those are business advisors. So recognizing that someone may be a tremendous farmer, but may not have, know how to file their tax forms or may not know how to grow their business. I mean, there's so many things that have to be known beyond just farming to be successful. So the objective of that program is to make our farmers not only, to allow them to not only survive, but to thrive
and be business savvy.
Right. Learn what they can do because it is complicated. To be a farmer, and so it's really about maintaining economic vitality for those
you guys
businesses.
Do. If there's so much going on in your agency,
there is.
And if may I say, do you know how many people you have working in the agency?
It's about 140.
That's really not a whole bunch of people to do all that you do. I've always been surprised by when I hear the number of people. Anton will love me for this, but seriously, what you do.
Well, I'll say what our agency does
because it's not all you.
It amazes me too. I'm a lawyer, and most of my career I've spent trying to fix problems after the fact. this agency is full of people who are accomplished things prospectively.
That's great.
And it's a welcome change of perspective, and they really are incredible at trying to keep pushing the envelope and keep fighting for the things that they're quite passionate about preserving.
That's great. So listen, can we just switch to Act 31? I did a show on this because I thought it was fascinating. It's limiting liability for agrotourism. It's shifting responsibility from – it's more like people who visit farms and participate in farms, and up until this bill – if they got injured, would sue the farm. And maybe you could talk a little bit about this. I do have to now I have to take a quick break. I'm a quick learner. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We'll be right back to talk about agrotourism.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Sorry we messed up the break, but they'll forgive me here, I hope. Anyway, we're in the midst of talking about agrotourism, Act 31, and I wanted to talk about how important that was. I don't know if you know much about the bill itself, but there was a lot of what one should do to cover one's liability as a farmer.
Yeah, we think it's a really important development, and I want to caution everyone though that you can always be sued. So that no matter whether the law is in your favor or not.
Yeah.
So the first thing you want to do is try to be as safe as possible, because if anyone gets hurt, you can wind up in a lawsuit whether you're right or not. So, but that said, we think farms are potential economic drivers for rural communities. We think that a farm with a corn maze or with a farm stand, or maybe it has it develops and has a slaughterhouse and actually gets its meat inspected or brings its beef somewhere and brings it back to sell it from the farm. We think all of these things are essential. You know, as our small towns lose their stores and perhaps consolidate their schools, we think that farms are a potential driver to maintain vitality in the rural community, so that all of our kids who grew up there don't decide to move somewhere else. So we want everybody wants rural Vermont to remain vital. So one way to do that is to develop that connection between the consumers, between the locals, between the tourists to the farm. And because of the way that farms operate, there are inherent risks on every farm. There are animals, there's equipment, there's tractors. And so there is a necessary caution from farmers about bringing people to their property. So what this does is it basically it transfers the risk from the farmer to the consumer for the inherent risks of farming. It doesn't excuse a farmer's negligence, but it does excuse those things that are inherent risk, provided, and this is very important, that farmers who are engaged in any of these agritourism activities, that they post a very specific warning. It's in the statute. We have it on our website, but it has to be, and UVM has also been putting out information about it.
Oh, good.
It's a very specific sign that has to be posted so that everybody who engages in these activities understands the law and understands that if something should happen to them because of these inherent risks, then they're responsible for them instead of the farmer. And that same language has to be in any contract that the farmer may have with a person. And it doesn't cover some things like retail and lodging, which are not considered agritourism activities. But if you're having people on your farm to engage in these activities, which can be a lifeblood for a farm and also for consumers, it's what it's doing is it's saying that we, the consumer, are accepting that risk and we know about it. Yeah. But if they don't know about it, they can't be forced to accept it. So that's that's a key component.
I was a commissioner of the Department of Labor for a couple of years, and one of the biggest issues we dealt with were accidents on the farm. So this is a serious issue, and people need to pay attention when the farmer says, "Don't touch."
Absolutely,
stay away, because that was a very big issue. We actually had when I was serving as the commissioner some serious injuries leading to death. I mean, it's something you really need to pay attention to. So when you see the sign out there, read it and pay attention.
Yeah, and don't climb on the old hay elevator.
Yeah, right. Well, because I can't. I would imagine that the cost of insurance without this law is pretty staggering for farmers, and they can least afford to spend money on insurance.
This should certainly help. I mean, insurance companies are going to price out their rates depending on their own assortment of factors. But but it should absolutely help for them to know that provided that farmers aren't being negligent, that they're that
and
the
that's
inherent
an important
risk.
Obviously, if the farmer knows that big hole is there in the field, he should fill it.
Right. Or that, if they're using a horse for trail riding that always throws off its rider, then that's
– Oh, that's a good one to know. Write that one down. Anyway, so skipping to Act 67, I was curious mainly because of the previous hour we did. It says creates the Universal School Lunch Task Force. Is that more of a farm to school issue, or do you know what that task force was meant to do?
So I think there are two parts to that bill. One of them is encouraging local food in the school system.
Right.
And then the other piece was creating a task force to explore the possibilities of free universal lunch to all Vermont students. So I think that's a little bit
that's different.
A little bit different, yeah.
Yeah. I must say I'm torn about that. I'm rather frugal. But on the other hand, when you hear some of these stories about kids being shamed because their parents didn't have money in the account and they refused. Seriously, people. I would go broke if I was working behind that food counter because I'd be giving the kids the money because it's terrible. How do you do that? Anyway.
Well, that's an important public policy question, and obviously every person should have enough food, and obviously they don't all. And in schools, they do all have enough food in the schools, but the question is whether or not they should pay for it, and you're absolutely right. No one should endure any stigma for something that's completely beyond their control, and everybody needs to eat. So,
yeah, and it's there for a specific reason. I mean, if you do lose your job, you've got that fallback system, and hopefully when you get a job, you would perhaps get your children out of the program, but it's there if you need it. And maybe we do have to do that. I don't know. Jury's out on that one.
Well, you could look at it in so many different ways, but when people play basketball or soccer, the school provides the uniforms. When people do a lot of school activities, it's paid for by the taxpayer. And whether or not lunch should be provided, I think you can easily argue either way, but there's no question that everybody who's at school should be having food.
I agree with that. No, that's for sure.
And the more of it that can be local food, the better.
Yeah. Well, I must tell you, I don't mean to waste your time here, but when I've been to restaurants that have farm to plate and you read on the menu that, you know, the eggs come from Pat McDonald's farm down the road on route, 203. I mean, how cool is that?
It's great.
I mean, it's just, and it just tastes so much better. I don't know whether it's mental, but I really think it does taste better.
I think a lot of times it does.
Yeah, I know that meat tastes better when I bought it. So anyway, let's just talk about the act. Oh, here we go. Act 22 relating to tier 2 raw milk producers expanding their sales capacity. As I told you in the break that I'm a little torn about this one. Why don't you explain that?
Sure. So what the bill did itself is not tremendously different than what already existed.
Right.
What the bill so raw milk is not pasteurized milk. So most milk and everything that most consumers buy is pasteurized, meaning that the potential pathogens in the milk are taken out through that process. Raw milk is direct from the farm to the consumer. And because of the risk of pathogens in the milk, it's pretty strictly regulated about how that can happen. I think it was in 2013 or so, but it may be even a little bit before that raw milk first became legal to sell in Vermont. And over time, that's comes up several times in the legislature, and there's a lot of passion on both sides of it. And we are, as an agency, conflicted about it because it is a real economic development piece for some farmers. Some farmers, I heard one not long ago who was, I think she was from out of state. She came to Vermont to go to school, fell in love with it, had never farmed in her life, fell in love with dairy cows somehow, and wanted to start a business but had no money. And so she started her business by selling raw milk, and eventually mm-hmm. she got enough business to enough money to expand her farm a little bit, and I think she's maybe even now processing her milk.
Great.
But you can get about a 6 to 7%, 6 to 7 times more money for raw milk than you can through the federal marketing milk order. Now, it's a huge difference in price. Some people believe that it has health benefits. We're not aware of any evidence to support that. The agency's not. Our health department has testified on this issue, is very concerned about the risk. And I think the health risk, and it's particularly to kids, because kids are often most vulnerable, mm-hmm. and kids are really not the ones making the choice about whether or not to assume that risk or
right.
not. So it is a difficult issue. We do support it as a means of economic development for farmers. We're also very concerned about any health effects, I think, as anyone is. So it's what happened in this bill, though, was that before this bill, farms could only sell raw milk either directly from the farm or through a farmer's market. So also directly to consumer. Mm-hmm. What this bill did is allowed some of those producers to sell through a farm stand or through a CSA.
Okay.
So it expanded the scope of the potential right. sales, but didn't change its reach a lot. And, mm-hmm. and the warning still is required that people, I mean, the goal here is a little bit like the agritourism, is to make sure consumers are aware of those risks. We don't want any consumer to think they're buying pasteurized milk when they're buying raw milk.
Right. And when this first came up years ago, and I was in the legislature, I actually voted no for this bill because I, as the consumer, was allowed to bring my own container. And all I thought about was, and what if I don't clean that container and my family gets sick and I'm running around going, you know, Farmer Joe gave me bad milk, and I thought that wasn't good. But I think what I've heard now is that farmers do provide. I feel better if they provide and sanitize their own containers.
You know, I think there's a provision in the law about sanitizing the containers, and I just don't recall. It's been a while since I read the bill.
No, that's okay.
And I don't remember for certain whether that's allowed. E.B. Flory, our dairy division chief, would know immediately,
yeah.
and and someone could call me, and I could easily look it up too, but I'm just not certain about the containers.
Yeah. Well, I just – that was the thing that bothered me the most about that bill, so – but I have a feeling they've changed some of it. We do have a caller. It's Fred from Newberry. Fred, welcome to the show.
I'm Maureen.
Hi.
Hey. I got an interesting story. There was an old Vermont friend, and he had a telephone buddy, a Texas rancher. And so the rancher kept pestering him, said, look, you got to come out and see my ranch. You just have to come out and see my ranch. So the Vermont farmer says, okay, I'll come out and see your ranch. So he goes out, and they're having breakfast, and the farmer says, why don't we hop in your truck and take a ride around your fence line? And the rancher said, well, you know, it takes all day to do that. He says, I know. I got a truck just like it.
Is that a Newberry joke, Fred?
No, it's a dumb dad joke.
Dumb dad joke. Well, cool. Thanks. That was very good. You put a little humor in the show. That's a good thing. Thanks for calling in, Fred. So we're back with Steve Collier, General Counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. I liked it better when it was just ag. That I could remember. So we were deciding whether we should continue on with our legislative discussion, and we're going to take something from one of the bills that got passed. It was the Vermont Hemp Program. Do you think you could chat a little bit about that? That piqued my attention when I saw it.
Sure. Well, hemp is such an interesting crop because it's the only crop that if you don't grow it right, it's a federally controlled substance, marijuana.
Oh, well, yes, there you go.
So the object here was – and hemp was not legal in any capacity until the 2014 Farm Bill. And after that, the standards changed in the 2018 Farm Bill. And the 2018 Farm Bill made the program significantly more restrictive and made it harder to grow legally compliant hemp. So we have been continuing to operate in the state of Vermont under the 2014 standards. And it all comes down to how THC, which is a psychoactive ingredient in marijuana or hemp, it's not so psychoactive in hemp because the level's so low, but it is psychoactive in marijuana. It's defined differently under the 2014 Farm Bill and the 2018 Farm Bill in the way that it's calculated. It's kind of complicated if I get into how it's calculated, so I don't think I'll do that now. But essentially what the law did this year was allowed us to, the amendment to our housekeeping bill this year allowed us to stay under the 2014 Farm Bill program because Congress extended it last year through this year, this growing season. So right now we continue to operate under the 2014 standard, which is more permissive. If we go to the 2018 standard, it may be more likely that farmers will either have to remediate their crop by destroying the flower, which is part of it, or even destroy their crop. Next year is still up in the air because Congress has not extended the 2014 pilot project for this next coming year. It's in an appropriations bill. We're hoping that it will be passed, but we don't know whether it will be or not. So next year, the 2018 standards will kick in unless Congress extends it again.
Don't you love them? What can we say? We're not turning this into politics. How many farmers are involved with hemp, either 100% or partially, I would assume?
Well, the numbers have gone down. I'm not sure exactly what they are, but at the beginning of the hemp program in Vermont, a lot of people started it, and now the numbers have gone back down. A lot of that, I think, is more to do with finding reliable buyers. A lot of people started growing it without a contract to sell, and then at first the market was skyrocketing, and then it sort of plummeted a bit. And right now I think it's leveled off, but there are still – I can't remember the number of actual producers, but it's significant.
Yeah.
And we believe it's an incredible crop with a lot of potential, including even potentially in developing plastics and developing animal food. There's a lot of –
Didn't they use it for what is it? Between the walls to keep the
insulation.
Insulation. Thank you. There's a word.
It has a lot. Yeah, it has a lot of sort of incredible uses, and it's been out of use for so long that we're sort of working. Our producers and farmers and industry is working on sort of remembering all of its uses. But we do think it's a valuable crop. It's going to take a while probably to develop exactly how it fits in. It also has some soil advantages in that it sucks up a lot of contaminants, but definitely nutrients from the soil. So there's a lot of different ways that it could be quite useful, but it has that challenge that if it's not grown correctly, it's marijuana. And that raises a lot of other issues and just make – normally if you grow a crop that's not successful, you don't potentially have to destroy it.
Right.
or not as successful as you'd like it to be. So it's
– Well, I remember when this all first started to be talked about, and I knew a lot of farmers got into that because it had some great potential.
And it still does. And it's just a regulatory rubric that doesn't apply to corn as an example. We think it can be very successful and some people have had tremendous success with it.
Great.
But there are more legal developments that really probably need to happen before it can be as successful as its potential indicates.
Okay. So just two more things. First, there's this thing called Farm First. And I found this very interesting because it dealt with providing resources and support for farmers. And it's a stressful job. So we talk about getting up at oh dark 100. And you're dependent on the weather. You're dependent on grants. You're just dependent on technology. And a lot of farmers need some help with health problems, depression, all kinds of things. So what is Farm First?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So Farm First is a resource that's available for all Vermont farmers to call and to get help. And it's free of charge up to the limited number of meetings that you can have. And we actually just secured through Diane Bothfield's work. She's our administrative services director. And through our request from Anson Tabbitts, our secretary, a grant from the USDA to further expand those services. So we're working with DALE, which is another – it's a Department of Aging and Independent Living. and also with Weber, which is an association. I'm not sure exactly what Weber does other than their work in this Farm First program, but we're working to expand the resources available. They want to develop a peer network of farmers to That's help right. each other, and then also to get even more counseling sessions for any farmer who needs to. And you're absolutely right. Running a farm, doing it on your own, right. being in isolation oftentimes, dealing with the economic challenges, that is incredibly stressful yep. for a lot of people. And every farmer should know there are resources to help, and that we really encourage people to take advantage of that. And sometimes just talking through it, getting access to additional resources like mm-hmm. farm and forest viability, like we talked about before. Our agency has a lot of people that can talk farmers to help with their business plan, but getting that counseling sometimes yep. is what someone needs just to get a right. fresh perspective.
You just think it takes one tropical storm Irene to completely wipe you out. And I wouldn't think farmers have that kind of savings, because they have to, there's so much expenses on the farm. You've got to pay your farmhands, you've got to buy technology, and you one moment and it's gone.
They're responsible for a lot.
Yep.
And so any help that they can get, and the first step, right, is recognizing that there is help and that maybe you need some right. and that there's no shame in requesting it. So you're right. Farmers manage an incredible amount. We need them, and their families need them. And so they should understand that this is a resource that can very much help.
And we love them.
We do.
Yeah. I have just 2 minutes left, Steve. And I know if you can talk really quickly about what we're doing to protect our food safety here in Vermont.
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. And I think a lot of what we are trying to do is to make sure that we're better prepared for the next emergency. And hopefully it won't be a health-related one, but it's inevitable, right, that there is going to yep. be some additional future emergencies, whether they're regional, local, national, or international. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that we're as best prepared as possible to meet those challenges. And I think if I understand the governor's message right, what he really wants is infrastructure. He doesn't want to expand government to a lot of additional programs that will require additional funding forever. I yep. think what he wants to do, and I think what our agency wants to do, is to build infrastructure now. As an example, with meat processing and slaughter
right,
processing,
right.
So build that infrastructure now so that our farmers have access to it, so that we have that local food that we can more readily get to the consumer, and to make sure that we're all protected and our farmers can remain viable.
That's great. Well, we've got some hardworking folks in this state. And, Steve, I want to thank you for coming on. You learned a lot in your year and a half. Is that right? Good job. So we're signing off, and I just want to thank all of our guests today. I love talking about food, and I'm looking forward to looking to buy food from the farmer. I think that's a good way to go, folks. Anyway, Rick will be back tomorrow. This is Pat McDonald from WDEV on Vermont Viewpoint.